The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Max Rushton, and this is Guardian Football Weekly. Today, 10 goals for Manchester, while the rest of last season's top six drop points. David Luiz's right foot gives us a great opportunity to waste more time discussing high feet and big lunges. Elsewhere, no magic for Roy and Ray. Crystal Palace may never score again. Plus, Harry Redknapp sacking Sid in Spain, your questions and feedback corner. And that'll all do nicely for today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel, Barry Glendenning. Feels like it was only yesterday.
Because it was. Hello.
Hi. Philip Eau Claire.
Feels like it was what?
It feels like it was like 2 weeks ago.
Something like
but
that.
But I wish
yes.
It was yesterday.
Oh, it's so sweet.
Would you be interested in co-presenting a Sunday radio show if I was to lose my current sidekick?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, let's talk. That's all right, Baz. Jackie Oatley, pod debut.
Hello.
Welcome. Would you say this is a career high, or were you just not busy?
No, today? This is absolutely it.
This is
very exciting.
This is
the
pinnacle.
You've got like a studio with windows. You see people working and maybe writing stuff.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
It's like what happens at a newspaper.
It's like
when
people go to work and stuff,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I noticed on the top of Jackie's Twitter page, the photo is her sitting at a table with Ryan Giggs, Ian Wright and Emmanuel Petit. I fully expect that to change by close of play this evening.
I have just taken a little video of you being here because it is that exciting.
Although, to be fair, Jackie did sit in Barry's chair when she walked in. That's a huge...
No, I didn't even get that far.
No,
I was
didn't.
Warned off it straight away, yeah. And then I popped out and came back. My bag had been moved and everything, and I was warned in no uncertain terms, don't even go.
As long as it doesn't get into something like the Galas Nasri incident, when Nasri sat in the wrong seat on the bus.
Oh, right. And what happened?
Galas slapped him.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, absolutely. Nasri had sat in Thierry Henry's seat on the bus. Which is terrible because it's a superstition within the French team dating from 1998. We've already started to talk about football, amazingly.
I know, this is really good. Thanks for bringing it back to sport.
They were convinced that amongst the mass of superstitions that enabled France to win the World Cup, as it is because of superstitions, of course,
yeah.
One of them was that they never changed their seats on the bus. Ever. That seat was Thierry Henry. And that was that. And whoever dared to sit there was in for some talking to, as Samir Nasri was. Clip around the ear.
He did it on purpose, did he?
Of course he did.
Being Samir Nasri.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to...
Would your performance change drastically, Barry, if you were to sit in one of the other two chairs assigned?
I have done that before, and it feels a bit weird. I imagine it's what it's like for a team playing away from home. It's similar kind of thing. You're doing the same thing, but the surroundings are just slightly different and make you that little bit more uncomfortable.
Is that like Tottenham at Wembley?
Probably, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the Barry hoodoo if we put you somewhere else. Right, should we start? Let's start Old Trafford because it happened most recently so we can all remember it. Manchester United 4, Everton 0. Philippe.
I was there.
You were there? Oh, brilliant. Well, tell us about it. From watching it on television, I thought... Manchester United still aren't brilliant.
Yeah. No.
They're scoring a lot of goals and not conceding many.
No, and I've read an awful lot about how Everton were abysmal, how Koeman should be sacked, and how this and how that. And the fact is, Everton were not brilliant, to say the least. But up until the, I think, 93rd minute, something like that, when the second goal goes in, Mkhitaryan, they'd actually given Manchester United quite a few scares. And it probably revolved... You know, looking at it a bit coldly, on the decision that Koeman took to remove Gay from midfield, he decided, okay, let's go all for, you know, attacking, bringing in Sandro, then Miralas. And as a result, he found himself a little bit overrun in midfield late in the game. But otherwise, I thought Everton, given how mediocre they've been since that second half against Tottenham, give them a real game. Which, of course, when you read the scoreline, or you see the highlights, you think, maybe not. The fact is, they had more chances than Manchester United before Mkhitaryan's goal, which is odd. I'm still not completely convinced by Manchester United, but I'm wondering if it's not something to be said in their favour. Because if you win 4-0 and are so lacklustre, lacking in rhythm, heaven knows what they're going to be like when they do find a rhythm, and they will at some point.
It's interesting because after the game, everyone's going, well, it wasn't a 4-0 game. And I know what they mean by that, but I felt like reminding people that the game does last 90 plus minutes. So if you score 10 goals in the 80th minute or later, as Manchester United have done 10 times this season, they do still count. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
not
fair. But just because, Everton,
I've written not a 4-0, just right there.
But it doesn't really matter. If they score a lot of their goals late on in the game, perhaps they're doing something right in the sense that they're wearing teams down, and the opposition have to remember that it's a 90-minute plus game, and they can't just mentally switch off after 83 minutes, which is when they scored the second goal. So credit to Manchester United for that. And also, I mean, looking at Rooney sitting on the bench after that, you know, it was 1-0 when he went off. But it is up to the rest of the team to be able to cope with whatever Manchester United have to throw at them and to take their chances. So therefore, they deserve the 4-0 scoreline.
It kind of reminds me of Laurie Sanchez's disastrous reign at Fulham, when he kept defending himself by making the point that if matches only lasted 45 minutes, they'd have been in the top four.
Would he be managing Real Madrid now if football was
possibly,
just 45 minutes?
But, I didn't think Everton were terrible. I thought it was one of their better performances, although the bar is quite low. But even by playing well, they still didn't manage to lay a glove on United at all, you know. And
Rooney should have equalised, shouldn't he? Sigurdsson had a chance as well?
Yes, very good
when
chance.
It was at 1-0?
They do seem quite ponderous, though. There's a big lack of pace in that side.
I thought Tom Davis was playing very well as well. So, Philip, you say taking Gay off was a mistake. I thought taking Davis off as well was a mistake.
The funny thing is that when you're doing... I was doing work for the French TV station, and you're sat next, as Jackie will know, you're sat exactly next to the dugout. So I could overhear what... the Koeman brothers were talking about, and I could also hear Bing Dunk just shouting at every single player going within earshot, or not, as it were. And Davies did a couple of things which they thought were clearly showed that his head was not completely in the right place in terms of the decisions he was making. He was doing some really good things. I mean, good close control. He was going past players. He was trying to go forward to move the ball properly. But on the other hand, there's still quite a bit of... you can pare a lot away from Davis's game. He's still very raw,
he's
very
19
young.
Years of age,
he's 19 years of age. He looks about 14 as well.
He does. Bless him. Now he's shaved. He was a little baby face, wasn't he? But the rest of the Everton outfield side average 28, and you know, I'm sure we'll come on to Newcastle in a bit, but they're averaging 25, and their 23-year-old captain Jamal Lascelles is saying we're playing really well because we're really young and we can sense that everybody else is leggy. And Everton, I was at their very first game of the season in July at home to Rosumbrock, and the sense of excitement around the place was unbelievable. There was a lady in the toilet cubicle next to me banging away on the cubicle. She went, I don't know who you are, but I'm just so excited for the season. I can't believe it.
I see. She was definitely talking about the football.
I think she was talking to me about the football, I think. And then they kicked off. But it has been a really, really difficult start for them as well.
I was wondering where that was going.
Hey, Ronald Koeman was angry after the game. Mourinho had written in the programme, we're up against a team that spent 140 million. Obviously, yeah, we're playing a team that wants to get at least a top four position. He told Jose to get realistic. Everton need more time. I mean, that's just Jose writing something for writing's sake, isn't
he? His programme notes were quite funny because there was also, he said, you know, we should all, I'll give Wayne Rooney a big hug, but don't be too nice to him. And he also say, I hope that the noisy supporters are back from their holidays. Yeah.
What did we all think of Lukaku celebrating against his former club? What a total disgrace to football that is. He should have just put his hands in the air and said, no one come near me and no one
That's
hug me
did.
Or anything.
But if he's going to get stick during the game, then of course you're going to give it back. That's what you do, isn't it? And I saw another angle of when he teed up Mkhitaryan for his goal. And as soon as he slid the ball into him, almost before it hit the back of the net, he was already putting his finger to his lips to the Everton supporters as if to say, there you go, that's shut you up, hasn't it?
I've mentioned it before, and I think it's Will Grigg, and I can't remember who he's playing for or against, but he scored against his former club and he did the hands in the air. He was right up against, you know, his former club supporters, hands in the air, say, I'm not going to celebrate. They all started clapping, and then he went, nah, I got you, and ran off cheering wildly. It was brilliant. Manchester United are joint top with Manchester City, who won 6-0 at Watford. A Watford fan tweeted before the game, at least it won't be as bad as last year with the 5-0 scoreline. Unlike United, City are playing with just this incredible sort of attacking flair, and it's I mean, it's down to the players they've got, isn't it?
Yeah, and against the Watford team that was was not ridiculous at all, that really tried to take the game to them, that had, you know, some organisation, that has some half-decent players. And to be honest, it was a wonderful game to watch for a while, before the offside goals and all that. And
they did get some decisions, City.
They did, and which probably put a flattering veneer on the scoreline, but everybody agreed that, you know, they're just, at the moment, they're untouchable in the Premier League. Whether they can translate that into, you know, the European stage, I don't quite know. But the most remarkable thing is the way that Jesus and Aguero are dovetailing up front. I don't think many people were expecting that, because Guardiola has never played with two up front, has he, before? I don't think so. And with De Bruyne a bit, not as perhaps as forward as he was in the previous season, and who was absolutely magnificent. No, I mean, the superlatives, I mean, we ran out of them pretty quickly. It was absolutely magnificent. Terrifying, actually. The speed, the
terrifying.
Pace. Yeah, terrifying.
Wow.
Well, if you were to put together a clip of a Manchester United attack and a Manchester City attack, it probably would feel as if you've sped up the film by two or by three when you're watching City. That's how good they
is
are.
Is it Paul Dawes wrote a good piece about, you know, they've invested well in their fullbacks, haven't they, which makes such a big difference now going forward. And yeah, that whole narrative of Aguero not being a Pep player, is that finished now? Are we finished with that?
It's definitely finished for now, hasn't it? And the way they are combining those two up front, I don't think we expected that, did we? We thought it was going to be one or the other. But I love to see the way they celebrate together and teeing each other up, and the way that Aguero teed up Jesus the other day. That was wonderful to see. And I always like to see when a player scores a goal, when he turns to the player who's teed him up. I think that shows a lot of camaraderie and team spirit, and shows the way things are going in that place.
The I'm not Roberto Firmino type of celebration.
Yeah, compare that to what went on at PSG as well last night. But that's
ooh,
another
dear
story.
That's different.
Well done to Aurelio Gomez, who went on goals on Sunday yesterday, which is probably not interesting for anyone who doesn't work in TV when you book footballers. But when you've got one booked and they're playing the game the day before, you're absolutely desperate that they don't get sent off or they don't get pumped. And to lose 6-0 and still go on with his big smiley face.
Just, and Cammy said, I did give him an out. I was thinking, why did you give him an out? Just ignore him and hope he shows up.
Was he wearing his gum shield on television?
Oh, I hope so.
No,
he wasn't. He took off the colourful gum shield.
He's a good bloke, though, isn't he? He came across really, really well on that show. And he was good because he gave proper insight. He says, when these players are coming at you, there's not a great deal you can do. But in fairness to them, Watford are not going to be judged on their matches against Manchester City this season. And they've got a manager in Marco Silva who's very, very thorough, and he'll have prepared all sorts of stats and facts and everything, but there's nothing they could do about it. City were just too good on the day, and then you just take it and you move on.
Chelsea 0, Arsenal 0, Barry. Did you prefer the first 87 minutes or the last 3 minutes of this game?
Why do you ask?
Well, just because there was a red card and everyone fouled each other for the last 3 minutes.
Yeah, I enjoyed the game. I kind of had a feeling beforehand that it was going to finish in a draw. I didn't think Arsenal would lose. I didn't think they'd have enough about them to win. It could have gone either way. I don't think David Luiz can have any complaints about the red card, although, you know, people are complaining that the game is no longer manly enough. But by, you know, the letter of the law, that's a red card, and he was already in a booking anyway, so it was certainly a yellow.
He was a walking red card in that game anyway. He lost it completely.
Yeah, and when
after his first yellow, he started to play at centre of midfield, right winger. He was popping all over the place. I was watching the game in Manchester with Rémi Gard, the former Villa and manager and Arsenal player, and we were looking at him and he's gone now. He's going to get sent off. You could sense it, and if that's not manly, that was cowardly.
So basically, Antonio Conte didn't do what I did on Saturday for Polytechnic Fours, and I'm injured, so I'm just managing, which is I bought Kyle on 10 minutes into the second half, and I took him on 15 minutes later because he was going to get sent off. He threw his shirt on the ground and drove home. So we haven't spoken since, so, you know, if you're listening, we'll chat in the week about the future. It's interesting you say that. I mean, look, the red card, Conte's saying, hey, it's not fair because Sanchez was nibbling at him.
Well, of course he is. That's what he would say. He's going to defend his players, isn't he? That's what you do.
But why Why does he? Why doesn't he say, do you know what? It was a red card because he went over the top and he'll learn from it.
Oh, it would be lovely if they did that. But how managers... And when they do, we all applaud them afterwards on Twitter, don't we? Journalists have been in press conferences. Go, really refreshing for a manager, to be honest. But these top managers, it's a siege mentality, isn't it? They want to create that to make it look like the world's against them, and it helps build up their own players.
Do we want?
I don't see what they have to lose by coming out and saying, yeah, no complaints. It was, you know, it was... Shouldn't have done it, and he deserved to be sent off.
On the red card, Bankhead asks the question, I've just watched Michael Oliver spend minutes explaining to Antonio Conte the red card decision on Luis. Why? We all saw the incident. Conte saw it better than anyone else. Why take time to explain what is bleeping obvious? Even if you dispute that it merited a straight red, it's crystal clear why Oliver made the decision. You might as well argue about what shade of blue the sky is.
Probably because his fourth official's getting absolute dog's abuse for it, and so he could just explain to himself. He's one of the best at that. When you watch Michael Oliver during a game, really, really good at calmly explaining to players and managers why he's made a decision. He's firmly in control of the situation, and he's explaining it, and that's the end of it. I really, really respect Michael Oliver.
David Luiz was booked for an overhead kick, which then cued a whole lot of chat about whether kicking someone when you're not looking at them is... not as bad as Mane, who was sort of looking at Edison when he kicked him, and then, you know, there was a big debate about it. Is there a debate? Joey Barton said it's different because Mane had his studs, and Luiz is kicking him with the instep, which is a softer part of the boot. How do we feel?
When would we bring a referee on the programme?
Oh, okay. Which one would you want? Jeff Winter?
I think actually Michael Oliver would be perfect.
Okay.
I think there's such a fine line, because I'm sad enough to sit and watch these things back in slow motion and press pause at the appropriate moments, which she's a little unusual. But that David Luiz overhead kick, it didn't go anywhere near his face. It was the soft bit, you know, the top of his boot. It was nowhere near studs. And it didn't hit Koscielny in the face. It was as his arm came up to protect his chest. His boot just flicked his wrist, and that was it. And it wasn't any higher than that. And so I do think there's a difference compared to two players coming towards each other. And I know Klopp says, oh, he didn't see him, not for 1 second, but he knew he was coming, and he was trying to flick the ball over his head, and he flicked his studs up into the air to try to get the ball first. So it is very fine margins. It's all happening at a million miles an hour, really, really fast, but there is a difference. And so I think Michael Oliver got that decision right.
You might say that because the idea, the notion of loss of control, intent doesn't play any part in Law 12. But the loss of control, I think you could say for Mane, yes, absolutely, he wasn't controlling his body. In the case of David Luiz, it's more a case he's not controlling his head rather than his body. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was doing an overhead kick trying to score. There was an element of accidentality about it. But we shouldn't spend too much time on this, I think, because the game had far more interesting things to it than that.
Oh, tell us the interesting things.
Well, the one thing that, first of all, it was by far the best performance of Arsenal in the league for a very, very long time. And it coincided with the fact of having Danny Welbeck and Alexis Iwobi just behind Lacazette. And the one thing which will have heartened, I think, many an Arsenal supporter is how they pressed high and intelligently. It was not just a running everywhere. They knew what to do and how they prevented Chelsea from playing the ball from the back and completely disrupted their rhythm as a result, and gave a really good performance. It was a truly, truly good performance, and very brave as well, very courageous. And it was linked to the presence of Iwobi and Welbeck, but also
to the
absence of Ozil and Sanchez. And Ozil is apparently injured.
Yeah.
Is he really injured?
Supposedly out of the squad. Who knows, really?
And Alexis was on the bench. So it was a definite decision taken by Wenger on this one, and one which paid off.
Isn't it weird, when you praise a manager for getting the best out of his players and not necessarily just letting them go on the pitch and do whatever the heck they like, but actually having some cohesive system and unit to counter the opposition, because that's not what we expect Wenger to normally do. They play the way they do, and it's just a bit odd that we're actually praising a manager for actually doing that.
Yeah, for something pretty obvious, such as Ramsey not doing silly runs, you know, far higher at the pitch.
Yeah, Ramsey had a great game.
So are you saying, Philippe, that there's a case for substituting graft and discipline for
it's not just
more obviously talented players?
Well, in terms of talent, you know, you wouldn't compare Ozil with any of his teammates in terms of pure class and elegance and, you know, easiness on the eye. Sanchez, maybe less so because it's not the Alexis Sanchez of a calendar year ago. But I wouldn't describe Iwobi or Welbeck as, you know, footballers who are deficient. They're actually pretty damn good, both of them. And what they brought was what the young guys have brought to Newcastle. And also, Lacazette had a big role to play, which is why he was substituted. He was absolutely, he was gone physically. But they were making life a misery for the three centre-backs, and which also enabled Bellerin, for example, on the right-hand side to have all these overlapping runs because on his flank, well, you know, you see your centre-backs, your three centre-backs having problems. You cannot wander up the pitch as, you know, Marcos Alonso, as he usually does. Mm. So therefore, they negated the threat, and at the same time, they created danger. So that was, you know, well done.
Bellerin is looking more and more like one of the three musketeers, which I think is
which
excellent.
One?
Oh, I'm not, who's the fat one? Not that one. Portos.
Portos.
Oh, so he's more Aramis. Is that one? Athos. Yeah, I'm going from Dogtanian more than the original.
Okay, all right. You know.
While we're on Arsenal, obviously we did the pod on Thursday, and since then there was the, you know, 20,000 people coming from Cologne, dancing around London, and varying reports depending on who you want to go with. This was all lots of fun and slightly mismanaged, or it was, had these been English fans over there, we would have, you know, we'd have absolutely slated them. This is an outrage. We're giving the Germans a free pass.
I thought some of the pearl clutching from some of my learned colleagues was kind of embarrassing, to be honest. The argument that had these been English fans over there, they've been slated, you're comparing apples and oranges, because had they been English fans over there, they would have been throwing chairs around, smashing windows, throwing bottles and attacking the police. That didn't happen over here. There were a couple of minor incidents, only four arrests. And I think the Emirates didn't really know what hit it in terms of atmosphere. And I think some people have... or I saw somebody, I can't remember who, describe it as the best atmosphere they've ever seen at the Emirates, including on the occasion when Arsenal beat Barcelona. So I thought some of the reporting was a bit hysterical.
Having spoken to a number of friends who are season ticket holders and who are at the game, I will say that they actually thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm terribly sorry to say that. Yeah, I think Barney wrote the definitive piece on the question. So to all our listeners, read... Barney's fantastic match report.
Critics would say this is very Guardian to not criticise German fans and be
that's
very
crazy,
critical.
You know, because it's actually, if you put aside, and I think it's possible to put aside minor skirmishes, and as Barry said, there were very few. It's the Guardian actually standing on for what I would say are traditional values of English football, as in you're having fun. As in, it's a bear pit in there. There's nobody is being beaten up or injured or anything like that. But the atmosphere is, you know, red hot, and it was really red hot on that particular evening. And so yes, there's a lot of hand wringing and from quarters. Actually, I'll tell you something which is going to get me a bit of trouble. By reading some of the comments and the comment pieces on that, I could definitely tell who voted for Brexit.
I think it sounded like there was a bit of an intelligence issue. It's not for the first time in football, but it seemed like everybody, Cologne-wise, Germany-wise, knew that 20,000 supporters were coming over, and it seemed only the Metropolitan Police and the security services didn't seem to know about that. So how come they didn't and weren't better prepared? I think that's the main thing, rather than it being a major, major issue. And, I think they'll know for next time, won't they? Hopefully lessons are learned.
Sorry. I met a friend for a couple of pints on Thursday evening after work around King's Cross, and there were hundreds of Cologne fans milling around and not an ounce of trouble of any kind, you know?
There's an interesting point, isn't there, that segregation is a very English thing. Mm. Is that not true?
No, not quite true. Don't forget, in France, for example, there are a number of clubs who are not allowed to bring away supporters to Ligue 1 games. So it's not just in Italy as well. You know, it's away supporters is very much an English tradition. Mm-hmm. That's true. Also German tradition for some clubs, and also Spanish tradition for very, very few clubs. But, for example, Athletic, I think, is one of them. Sid could confirm. But no, it is not... the idea that you keep away fans segregated and so forth is not specifically English in that such.
Back to the football, and we'll do the rest of the top half in a bit, but let's talk about Crystal Palace to end part one. Roy's first game, Barry, defeat Crystal Palace, the first top flight team in the history of English football since 1888 to lose the first five games and score no goals.
Yes, and there seems to be a very good chance they could become the first top flight team in the history of football to lose their first eight games and not score any goals, because obviously they've the two Manchester teams and Chelsea to come, I think, in their next
and the
week.
Ninth being Newcastle away.
Exactly.
The ninth being Newcastle away.
Okay.
They played a bit better, I thought.
They created enough chances to have won the game, I thought. I don't think anyone's expecting a quick fix from Roy Hodgson. He's noted for being very methodical, works relentlessly on training ground drills to focus on the team keeping their shape, and it's by all accounts very tedious. I read a piece Jonathan Wilson wrote about Fulham under Hodgson, you know, which is probably his finest hour as a manager, with that run to the UEFA or Europa League final, certainly his finest hour as a manager in this country anyway. And Simon Davis was quoted as saying that it took the players sort of more than 2 years to sort of buy into his philosophy. He's not going to get that time on at Palace, if recent history is anything to go by. But
if they don't score for 2 years, if they don't get it, be in League One.
Yes.
That's all possible too, but yeah, it's a difficult one with Palace, because it's not all over yet. Yes, five games, but there is a heck of a long way to go. And with 3 points for a win, it's not necessarily a new thing. But hey, a couple of those wins, look at what's happened to Newcastle, three in a row. They're what, top four or something silly?
Well, so, sorry, just yeah. One interesting-ish stat. Sunderland once lost their first six games of the season in the Championship under caretaker manager Niall Quinn. Roy Keane took over and marched them out of the division as champions. So all is far from lost. I'm not saying Palace will win the Premier League, but
sounds exactly like
they may well be okay.
Palace are in the bottom few places around Christmas time when Ian Dowie managed to get them promoted at the end of that season. Maybe they'll be clutching at straws there a little bit. But I think the concern here is, I mean, I was doing Final Score on Saturday and linked to a Roy Hodgson interview, and we all sat in the studio listening to him talk about there could well be more pain before things get any better. And I looked at Martin Keown and Danny Mills and we thought, oh, that's just brilliant, isn't it? If you're a Palace player, never mind a supporter, and you're listening to your manager going, well, there could well be plenty more pain before it gets better. It's, you know what he means with the next few fixtures, but come on, surely you've got to be more upbeat and say, look, there were signs in that game. Okay, we lost, we didn't score. There are signs there. I've got players here who can make a difference. I just need to get the right combination. We'll work on that during the week. You need your manager to be a bit more upbeat. And I think that's
slightly horror movie slight as well concern. When you take it as evil, yeah. Roy Hodgson going around hurting his own players.
He needs to get the midfield right, because Loftus-Cheek is now back and he had to go off because of a tight leg or whatever. But he needs to get moving quickly. But I'm just a little bit worried on that
and
front.
And when he gets as well, when he gets Mamadou Sakho fit again, when he gets Wilfried Zaha back on the pitch as well, it would be, I would expect a different Crystal Palace team. You have to remember the state that Fulham was in when he took over. Everybody thought they were going down, for example. And the same goes for West Brom. We took over for Roberto Di Matteo, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yes, and
is there any difficulty in the fact that, you know, any player that is 25 and under probably won't even remember that, and will only know Roy from losing to Iceland, and will look and go, "Why? Who are you? What?"
Yeah, I mean,
what?
There was a problem then, apparently, with the way he related to the players and younger players, you know, these are the reports that we hear. So that is a concern. And it wasn't also just about the result against Iceland. When I was at that game, and we could see it in all its full glory, about how the players were completely confused. They were overwhelmed. There was no clear direction coming from the touchline. Roy just looked as though he had absolutely no idea how to change the game. That was what was frightening, not just the result, and you know, you could lose to a penalty or a fluky goal or whatever. It wasn't like that. It was the fact that Roy had no idea how to change what was happening. And also his post-match, and then his next day, when he felt that he was forced by the media or friends in the media or whatever to go and face the media and say, well, I don't know what I'm doing. It was all of that. And also, sorry, Palace fans, I'm not being massively positive here, but also that run with Fulham to the Europa League final was 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. 7 years ago. So what's he done since then that is so well worth this position?
You're saying Roy out already, Jackie.
No, I'm not. I just
it sounds like these are the kind of methods that, you know, you're not going to pick up and embrace and get the hang of just once every couple of months on England duty, that you need to be sort of immersed in it every single day of the week. Go in, tie a rope around yourself, tie it to the next guy and the next guy, and then run up and down in straight lines. Sounds like absolute torture, to be honest. Those footballers will earn their money.
Hey, well done, Southampton, because they needed that win. Right, that'll do for part one. In a second, part two. Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly. Liverpool won, Burnley won. First of all, we've got to say well done to Burnley for what their first three away games being Chelsea, Spurs and Liverpool, and they're unbeaten. I didn't predict that, Philippe Auclair.
You didn't?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I didn't either. There's a few accumulators which went down the toilet with this one, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think so.
Not Barry's.
Barry didn't do an accumulator weekend.
Okay. Because the games were so hard to predict?
No, I just didn't bother. I don't have a crippling gambling addiction. I don't have to do an accumulator.
What do we learn from this game, Philippe?
I don't think we learned anything. I think we had confirmation of things we already knew or guessed or had an inkling might be true, as in defensive frailties. I'm talking about Liverpool, of course, here, about certain lack of quality in the finishing. 33 chances this time. You know, it was basically Sevilla part two, but against a much more modest opponent, really. Bit of bad luck, yeah, so what? But what I'm interested in is how Klopp's image is going to evolve, or has already evolved, with Liverpool fans. Because he's a supreme communicator. He can really wrap you around his little finger. I mean, having interviewed him after a number of games where things didn't necessarily go his own way, he's a master at extricating himself.
So you go in thinking, I'm going to hammer him, and then you come out
not hammer
him,
but ask him, you know, some delicate questions, some difficult questions, and one burst of, ha! And a few, you know, the twinkly eyes and you're my mate and so forth. And then you're helpless. And you become a hopeless journalist. You don't ask the proper questions. He's very good at that. But there's only so long you can carry on with what is going on in terms of results. I think his results are now in the league inferior to that of Brendan Rodgers. Is that correct? After the Sunday, it was about the same. Now it's gone below. And the fact that the same mistakes keep being made and the same areas in their game which needs improving on do not improve, I think people might start to ask questions. Not, you know, not fire Klopp, but what exactly is going on? Why is it that he cannot, you know, pass on the message to his players?
Atish says, do you think Liverpool will ever sort their defence out? If yes, which player defensive coach do they need to bring in?
Well, it all comes from the manager, doesn't it? And you just get the impression with Klopp, and he's very, very, he's very defensive in his outlook, not so much in the way he puts his team out, because he pretty much hangs his players out to dry in terms of the way they're set up on the pitch. I mean, we look at it in terms of the fullbacks bombing on all the time. You know, they've got a young kid and the opposition are clearly targeting him at the moment, Trent Alexander-Arnold. And it's almost as if it's just a case of, well, I like my team to go forward and therefore I'm going to put everything in that basket, all my eggs in that basket, and then when we concede loads of goals, well, it's just individual areas, it's just concentration, there's nothing else wrong apart from that. But it keeps happening, and it's been going on for a couple of years now, so it does come from Klopp. And so it's easy from the outside to say you should bring in a defensive coach, but managers don't tend to like to do that, do they? And we saw Loro going to Newcastle all those years ago. But we don't have that enough. I don't think we have these specialist coaches enough going. And you see all the ex-England players, how much they've got to offer, and why are they not going into clubs and offering their expertise on a you know, specific coaching basis of midfield or attack.
And when you look at what Steve Bould has been doing at Arsenal for the last 10 years, it shows it's possible.
But he's not allowed to, is he? I think we know that. He's not allowed to have that influence.
I was going to say this is very Wengerian from Klopp, because what we said about Klopp right now could be said about Wenger and could have been said for a number of years. The one year in which there was an extraordinary improvement in Arsenal's defence was the one year in which they employed a defensive coach, who was Martin Keown in 2005-2006, who was specifically brought in to be a kind of a father figure to the young ones, but also took over a lot of the coaching, or some of the coaching, for this back line, which at the time had Kolo Touré, Mathieu Flamini, Sigon, and things like that. And they went to the Champions League final without conceding a goal, as you might remember. And it was it only lasted for one season, I think.
Why didn't they keep him?
Well, I think Arsene doesn't like having people shining a bit too brightly in his own garden. And I mean, that's just personal understanding of it. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe Martin didn't want to carry on either.
He did.
There you go. But there was a definite improvement. So it's possible to bring in somebody who is, especially somebody who is involved with the club, has got, a distinct link and relationship with the club. But are you sure that Jürgen Klopp would want to do that? I mean, the problem is not just the fact that Lovren needs a very good centre-back by his side to be good, because he can be good. It's the fact they don't have a defensive midfielder, because neither Wijnaldum nor Jordan Henderson are defensive midfielders. The only one they had has gone, which was Lucas Leiva. I mean, you might say he was over the hill, but that's the only one they truly had in that kind of role.
Jackie, as someone who works with Martin Keown regularly, is he a bit sad whenever they bring up the classic Arsenal back four that he's not?
Do you know, he is so passionate about Arsenal, and he really likes Arsene Wenger. He's still got... I said feelings for him, that sounds a bit strong, but he still sees him as a father figure, and he has a huge amount of respect for him. He desperately wants Arsenal to do well, and I think he probably gets as frustrated as the rest of us, although I'm a neutral who would quite like to see them maximise their potential. When you see what they could be. And I think it's a similar situation, which he says, trying to change the subject, because I work with a lot of ex-Arsenal players and I don't want to betray any confidences. But
Sounds like Martin's a bit sad that he's not...
No,
I think so.
Well, no, it's not so much that. It's just that he really genuinely loves that club and hugely respects the manager and really wants them to do well. But of course, he gets asked as a pundit about it at every turn. Why is this happening? Why is that happening? And it's difficult for him, just in the same way as it is for Ian Wright, as it is for Lee Dixon, as it is for all the others. When things are going wrong, they don't want to put the boot into the manager at all. So they have to say it as they see it, but whilst maintaining that respect for the manager. And it's difficult for them.
Does anybody want to stick the boot in on Pochettino? Spurs nil, Swansea nil?
No, I don't think I want to put the boot in Pochettino. Okay. I mean, I found them very ponderous again. Mm. We're using that word a lot, aren't we?
Well, to be fair, I think Saturday's match of the day, through no fault of anyone involved in the presentation or production or punditry, was arguably the worst in the history of that fine programme's very long history. It was atrocious, the quality of football on offer. Apart from Man City, Watford, and Newcastle, Stoke wasn't the worst, but the rest was just...
I fell asleep on the sofa during the time.
I would give far more credit, I must say, to Swansea for what they did to Tottenham than I would give to Burnley for what they did against Liverpool. Far, far more credit.
Okay.
And maybe it's because I've got a lot of time for Paul Clement and talk about coaching and somebody who knows how to coach a team. I thought they defended extremely well, and they were one of these teams that I enjoy to see defending. I think there is a plan in place. It's not just that they know exactly what they've got to do, but they also are, when they've got the ball, they try to do something with it. And it's funny, actually. Remember, Swansea just a few weeks ago was saying, oh, God, it's terrible. Let's finish this. And I don't think anybody's saying that any longer.
Do you have no time for Sean Dyche, then? Is that how
it's not at all. I really like Sean Dyche. It's not that I when I look at the way that the teams are built, Sean Dyche is working to a template that has been extraordinarily successful. It's a long-term project with Burnley. Where relegation, for example, is not an absolute disaster, we carry on, we build on. Okay, fine. Swansea is totally different. They come from a playing culture, which, you know, if you remember the previous managers, where you've got Laudrup, Gary Monk, Brendan Rodgers, Martinez, and so forth, which is, you know, we play this kind of expensive, classy football, a kind of English-Welsh version of tiki-taka or whatever you would call it. And he has to work with a club which has got this tradition and survive. That's much, much more difficult, isn't it? And I thought they were really worth a point.
Spurs should have had two penalties, though, shouldn't they?
The Serge Aurier one, accidental knock, and yeah, perhaps. The other one, yes, there was one which was definitely a penalty.
I think it's important to credit a side when they're really well defensively organised, isn't it? Yeah. Really, really important. Because you credit a team when they score lots of goals and do well. So, well done, Swansea.
But it's not as interesting, is it?
Yeah, no, but they still deserve credit.
There's no shame in that.
Watching Swansea in recent times has become a bit of an ordeal, but, you know, it works for them, and I'm sure the supporters won't be complaining.
Jackie, you've mentioned Newcastle a couple of times already. In the Champions League spot, three straight wins. Well done to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? We talk about momentum so much in football that when you lose your first couple of games, oh, it's doom and gloom. Is Rafa going to go? The transfer window, he didn't get what he wants. And he's had this operation, and now they've turned things around, and everyone's talking about Jamal Lascelles, and I'd love to carry on talking about Jamal Lascelles, because I love seeing a young English player who is absolutely relishing the prospect of being a leader. He relishes being a leader. He speaks so well. I mean, that's not a new thing. He has done for the last couple of years in his interviews. He's really stood out. And his performances, of course. 23 years of age, youngest captain in the Premier League. And it's wonderful to see. And I mentioned earlier about how he's saying that we're enjoying being a young team playing against ageing players. It works in our favour. And they've got that M word going, the momentum. And long may that continue, because they can't bring in any more players. The manager's been asked about it non-stop, and now all that stops and they can focus on what they have got.
I saw, actually, when Rafael Benitez was interviewed by Gary Lineker on Match of the Day, he made quite an interesting comment in which he more or less admitted that previous press conferences up until when the transfer window shut had been openly messages to Mike Ashley, and that now the transfer window is closed, there's no point in worrying about that anymore. He's just playing with the hand he has because he can't get any new cards, and playing it very well.
Huddersfield and Leicester drew. West Brom, West Ham also was 0-0 in the exciting weekend of football. But look, Gareth Barry, 632 games, equaling Ryan Giggs' record.
The most cautioned man in the history of the Premier League. yes, absolutely.
Yes, but probably not. If you averaged it out, he probably isn't, is it? You know, it's only because he's been there for so long.
Yeah.
Does anybody want to give Gareth Barry some credit for playing for that long?
Yes.
It's a meaningless record. It's an utterly meaningless record, which is it's completely ridiculous, because it starts in 1992 and so forth, and it's really ridiculous. There are loads of players who've played far, far more games in the top division than Gareth Barry has. An awful lot of outfield players.
Demands on them.
Okay, all right. But I just don't understand this kind of records. Well done to him for making the most of his talent. Well done to him for being an England international. Well done to him for, you know, he's been an excellent player, a very good Premier League player throughout his career. Well done. But it's not, come on. I mean, I made a list of the number of players in terms of appearances in the league. He wasn't in the top 50.
Yeah, but in the old times, you could just walk around and have a cigarette at half time. Philippe.
Go say that to George Best, yeah.
That's a fair point.
I don't like Gareth Barry, and if I ever meet him, I'm going to tell him. And the reason why is because, and this is going back to accumulators, he once, when he was at Villa, he once missed a penalty, in very late penalty, I can't remember who they were playing, that cost me several £1,000 in winnings from about a £5 bet. And I've never, ever forgiven him for it.
Do you think he dyes his hair? It's very dark.
Oh, I can't say I've really thought about it or noticed it. Mm.
That's the sort of insight you get here.
Well, it is, isn't it? I think fair play to him, because he's been shoved around from centre-half to midfield to left-back, and he's he's in the James Milner mould that everyone likes to take the mickey because he's boring or what have you, but I think that's hugely underestimated and underrated, the fact that a player actually looks after himself and is a real professional. And yes, of course, he gets remunerated well for it, so need to be lauded as such, but I think it deserves credit, definitely.
Another old person who's still good is Jermaine Defoe. Vital win for Bournemouth. And well done to him. Slightly interestingly, Bournemouth and Brighton's next fixture is Bournemouth v Brighton in the third round of the Carabao Cup on Tuesday. Into the Championship, Harry Redknapp was sacked. Did anyone see Sean Teale's measured response?
No, I didn't. Tell me, please, tell us.
This is Sean Teale's former Villa player, obviously. His tweet, Redknapp sacked, laughing my cock off. Go and crawl back under your stone, saggy bollock face, he said. There is some previous, as you'd expect.
No.
This is an article. Harry
There's
Redknapp,
going to be some afters, too, I would imagine.
This is written by Harry, I think, it was on the Mail. In his column, headline, his wife tried to run me over. When I left Bournemouth and went to West Ham as assistant manager in 1992, I'd had enough of being the bad guy. When you're the manager, you put up that team sheet, half the club hates you, their wives hate you too. At Bournemouth, Sean Teale's missus nearly ran me over after a row over about £100. She marched down to the training ground over some minor contractual issue, gave me a mouthful, I told her to piss off, and the next thing I knew, she was reversing out the car park so fast, she nearly took me with her. So we should try and arrange a, you know... there are bad things happening in the world. We could get Harry and Sean together and just have them a cup of tea.
And Mrs. Teale. She's an important part of this.
In the glory years of Soccer AM, one of the very few ideas I got through was a game show called Teal or No Teal, which it didn't really have anything in it, but we just put Sean Teale in a massive red box and he jumped out of it. He was happier at that time. That's the happiest he's been since Harry got the sack.
Harry's got the sack. He brought in 14 players, but apparently they weren't the right players. He complained that he didn't have enough time to sort of gel them into a team. He's brought in some players there that are on some serious, serious salaries. Obviously, he's left them behind. Jota in from Brentford. Signed a 4-year deal worth £40,000 a week. David Stockdale left Brighton to go to Birmingham. I would imagine he's being well remunerated as well. Mark Roberts from Barnsley came in for £3.5 million. I think Birmingham are going to be in financial trouble. There were murmurings a couple of weeks ago that they were already warnings that they were going to be financially straightened because of Harry's summer purchases, and obviously it's not the first club he's left behind in something approaching financial turmoil, but he insists he would have got them promoted within 2 years. But
you can't help feeling Birmingham have made some mistakes since they were in seventh with Gary Rowett, yeah. Looking quite
imagine
good.
Imagine what you mean.
The Birmingham Mail, I think, is the paper, Jackie, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, they ran a survey over the weekend, fan survey, and 75% said they'd jumped the gun and fired Harry too early.
So. Really?
It's hard to argue against that, though, isn't it? I mean, how can you say that after bringing in 14 players, 8 games into the season, 3 games after the closure of the transfer window, when his main 3 players or his attacking players are injured, is that really sound business work? I would think that's an odd way to go about your business.
Did the paper ask what percentage would like Sean Teale to be the manager?
No.
You went to Millwall Leeds, Barry.
Yeah.
Did you have a nice time?
I did. It was a good game. I was home by 6:45.
Ah, it's important.
It's always important. But yeah, Leeds arrived and left as Championship leaders. Lost 1-0 in between. I would say they were very lucky not to lose 5 or 6-0. They were absolutely atrocious. It seems to have been an uncharacteristically bad performance, but Millwall just were rampant against them. And I mean, Steve Morrison, who's a former Leeds player, obviously missed 3 very good chances and spoke afterwards. He said he wasn't that bothered about missing all these chances. I suspect he may have been a little more bothered than he let on, but Millwall were very impressive, and if they continue playing like that, I think they haven't been getting the points their performances have deserved, but they got them eventually on Saturday. And if they play like that, keep playing like that, there isn't a hope in hell of them being relegated. Actually, afterwards, Neil Harris said that's not the best they've played. He said they've played better in a couple of games this season, which they didn't win. And I liked listening to him talk. He's very erudite. He's got very sort of firm ideas of how the game should be played, and just seems to be a really good guy. He must be one of the longest serving managers actually in the Championship at this point, is he?
Millwall, yes, he is. Wolves are second on goal difference. Jackie, you're a Wolves fan. Alfie says, ask Jackie whether Diego, is it Jota or Jota?
Jota.
Jota is as good as Robbie Dennison.
He's not quite. Robbie Dennison scored the first ever goal that I witnessed in a 1-1 draw against Bristol Rovers in 1990. Robbie Dennison was a great player.
First goal you ever saw, Philippe?
In a stadium?
Yeah.
Lost in the mists of time. It was a game that Le Havre played, but again, I was a wee boy. I can't remember who scored it.
Barry, can you remember?
It would be an Ireland under-16s match. I think that was the first football match I ever attended, Ireland under-16s. Can't remember who they were playing. Somebody scored. I can't remember who. No idea.
Probably won't include these nostalgic vignettes.
Somebody scored, don't know who, but that was the first goal.
Steve Spriggs, Cambridge United v Exeter, 85, I think. Anyway, are you happy with, we called them George Mendes FC early in the pod and got some stick from some Wolves fans.
Yes, rightly so.
Okay.
Because no agent has ever had any input into any other football clubs in the history of the world, have they?
No, never.
It's just that he's a very well-known one with great contacts, which is why he's there.
Are you accusing us of lazy journalism?
Very lazy, yeah. Although, of course, he does have links with the owners. But since when have owners not leaned on agents to bring players in and to get the right people? Because Chinese owners don't know people in football, do they? So they rely on people to help them out on that front. And more to the point, it's working. So it doesn't work every time, but on this occasion, those contacts are working. The manager, Nuno Espirito Santo, is one of George Mendes's men, and he has hit the ground running. He's got the right players in. He's got them organised, very, very organised. He is very sound. Everything he says is very measured, and the fans are riding on the crest of a wave and thoroughly enjoying the type of football they're seeing, because last season, frankly, was abysmal. In large parts. I went to 6 games at Molineux. They failed to score in 5 against the likes of Blackburn and Wigan and Barnsley. They lost 4-0 to. The fans are absolutely enjoying it. Nobody's taking anything for granted, but it's fantastic football and they've won 5 out of 8 so far.
Bolton and Brentford still yet to win, which is good news for you, Barry, because that means Sunderland aren't in the relegation zone and you stopped your losing run with a creditable draw.
Creditable draw at Hull, having been ahead. I couldn't tell you much more about it than that.
Are you nervous?
Yeah, a bit. Okay. People were asking me before the season started if I thought Sunderland were a good bet to go straight back up, and I was sort of laughing in their face, suggesting betting on them to go down might be more astute. And there's something deeply wrong at that club, and I don't know if Simon Grayson is the man to sort it out, which is not really a bad reflection on him. It's just a basket case club, and I'm not sure he knew what he was taking on when he took the job.
In League One, Shrewsbury extend their lead at the top to 5 points. In League Two, Exeter stays top. They won 3-0 against Crewe. Wickham's Adiyeke Mfemwa scored his 5th goal of the season in the first half against Luton. The visitors equalised in the 90th minute and got the winner in the 98th minute. And importantly, Cambridge United are into the playoff spots after winning the Dublin Daish Fineland derby against Coventry.
Have a little shout out to AFC Wimbledon as well.
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
First ever meeting with Blackburn, and they beat them away from home.
Well done.
Well done, Neil Ardley and Co.
Yeah. This week, round 3 of the Carabao Cup includes the All Premier League ties: Leicester, Liverpool, Palace, Huddersfield, West Brom, Man City. More fun games of potential giant killers against some reserve teams: Arsenal, Doncaster, Spurs, Barnsley, Burnley, Leeds, Bristol City, Stoke, Chelsea, Forest, Everton, Sunderland, and Manchester United v Burton.
But Barry hasn't got his Carabao box. I'm a bit disappointed by that.
It's downstairs in a locker.
I mean, I'd say, do you want to go and get
it? I'll bring it in on Thursday.
Yes. When we go through the results, you can open your Carabao box. That'll do for part 2. In part 3, we'll talk to Sid in Spain, feedback corner your questions, and that'll do. Welcome back to part three. Let's start in Spain. Sid Lowe is there. Hi, Sid.
Hello, how you doing?
Yeah, very well, thanks. So where should we start? Barcelona, 4 wins from 4. Didn't have it all their own way, did they, against Getafe? But Paulinho, no keepy ups. Paulinho was the hero.
Yeah, and I think this is the thing, isn't it? This is the guy that when he signed, fans were absolutely furious. And to be fair to the fans, that you know the context of it is that not so much that it's Paulinho's fault, although he took an enormous amount of criticism when he hadn't at that stage, of course, done anything wrong. But it was more that what he symbolised, that you know, a 29-year-old playing in the Chinese League turns up at Barcelona for €40 million at a time when they thought they were chasing Verratti and they couldn't get him. At a time when, of course, at that point, they still hadn't signed Dembele, who, by the way, is now injured for 4 months. Was still chasing Coutinho, and there was quite a lot of pessimism about them getting him. They signed Paulinho, and people went crazy. And a lot of people would say really, really quite harsh on him when it wasn't entirely his fault. Well, he came on and scored a great goal to win the game, a game that Barcelona didn't play well. They were a goal down. They came back to win 2-1 with goals from Denis Suarez and Paulinho, which suggests for the first time in a long time that maybe there is a little bit of strength in depth, because this is a team that, you know, last year, one of the big problems that they had, certainly compared to Madrid, was that there wasn't any. By the way, all three goals were brilliant.
Yeah, really, oh, the Getafe goal is glorious, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. A fantastic volley from outside the area. And Barcelona, living a little bit dangerously, but in the end did get the victory.
Sevilla second after winning at Girona. A big win for Real Madrid as well. 3-1 at Sociedad, who'd won all their games up to this point. And at 1-1, there was that real turning point where Sociedad hit the bar and Real got the other end and score.
Yeah, and I think this really is a significant victory. I mean, obviously, look, any victories for Madrid and Barcelona are significant in the sense that every time they drop points in Spain, it feels like a really big deal. We're talking about, you know, a league over the last, I think I'm right in saying that every year for the last 9 years, the team that's won the league has had at least 90 points. You know, when you drop points, it's really quite significant because the totals are very high, so the margins are very, very fine. Madrid have dropped 4 points already, going away to Real Sociedad, who'd won... I think it's 10. They've gone 10 games unbeaten. They really, really started the season very well indeed. They won 4-0 in Europe in midweek. And there was a sense that, wow, this is going to be tough. Madrid were without Cristiano Ronaldo, without Benzema. The pressure on Bale was really building. And there was a suggestion that they didn't have properly a substitute number 9, which I think is broadly true, given that both Mariano and Morata left in the summer. But Borja Mayoral, youth team player, well, I'd say youth team player, he's been in Germany last year, but you know, youth team player they brought back, was given a start, which perhaps was a bit unexpected. He scores the first Madrid goal. He sort of scores the second, and it's his ball, as you say, on that break, off the bar, up the other end. And then Gareth Bale scored a brilliant goal at the end, which was really, really quite important for him, I think, as well, because he's had the fans on his back quite a lot this season.
Yeah, it was classic Bale, wasn't just sprinting through and digging over the keeper. David
McGashin. They actually did the stats, you know, 35 kilometres an hour he ran at.
Really?
I think might be a record in Spain. Maybe
that's
even faster than
Iñaki
Williams.
Isn't that how fast racehorses run?
No, they go about 45.
Oh, really? Still pretty good. So he'd, yeah, in a horse race, quick. He would lose, but it, you know, he wouldn't be like an embarrassment.
Yeah, but I think he'd probably struggle if he had a little guy sitting on his back.
It's a fair point. Yeah. He'd be all right at the hurdles, though, I'm sure. David McGlashan asked Sid, can you ask Sid about the stand within a stand behind the goal at Sociedad? I've never seen anything like that before. It's like they bring in like 5 rows of people inside the running track.
They won't be doing it again.
Oh.
This was part of a kind of a test run, and they said after the game they admitted that they won't be doing it again. Anoeta is a stadium which is very pretty, but to be honest, in football stadium terms, is a bit of a mess. It just doesn't work in terms of atmosphere because of the running track. The fans are a very long way back. The stands are really quite shallow as well. So particularly if you're the back at the end, you're miles from the pitch. So what they're going to do is dig down, sink the pitch down, and then fill in the space between where the stand is now, covering all of the running track, and do it properly. But in the meantime, they decided, and a number of teams in Spain have done this, actually Mallorca did it and Almeria did it, to build temporary standing behind the goal, very close to the goal, and see if that changed the sense of atmosphere and try it out. There were a couple of, I must confess, I'm not sure the exact details of this, but there were a couple of kind of security issues or safety issues about it yesterday, and they said after the game they won't be doing it again. But the long-term plan is that they will do it again, because they will fill in the stadium properly and hopefully no more running track. Because Real Sociedad really do miss their old stadium, stadium called Atocha, which was very close to the pitch. And frankly, Anoeta is pretty awful. So I think with the redevelopment, it will make quite a big difference.
Sid, is it true that Adnan Januzaj was getting a bit of stick from the Real Sociedad supporters?
Yeah, although it's early for him. And there is, I think, a sense that he's going to be really quite a good player for them and quite important. He did this interview here, it must be about 3 weeks ago, basically the first interview with Diario As, and it was only very brief, but there's one nice remark where he said, I'm hoping to score my first goal so I can dedicate it to Luis Van Gaal, and he doesn't mean because Van Gaal's his favourite man. Mm-hmm. So that'll be fun when that happens.
Speaking of stadiums, Atletico's Wanda Metropolitano, yeah, their new home, all seemed to go quite well, except for Hugo Sanchez.
Yeah, I mean, it did go quite well. I mean, I the question, as you've just, in a way, is to frame it in what you've just said, their new home, and there's still that doubt of, will this feel like a home? Will this be kind of our place? And I think, obviously, with time, it will. They've been very, very conscious of that, and I am getting to Hugo Sanchez, although it sounds like I'm going off on a massive tangent. They've been very conscious of that sense of, you move 20 kilometres away, the other side of the city, a brand new stadium, when Atletico Madrid were kind of very conscious of being down to earth and a bit rough and a bit kind of raucous, and would this really work? And one of the things they've tried to do to bridge that gap is to make a very conscious embracing of their history. So a lot of the kind of the paraphernalia that goes around it has been consciously focused on history and consciously focused on their former homes. One of the things they've done is like a kind of a almost a Hollywood style walk of fame outside. So every player who's played more than 100 games has got a little plaque outside with on the pavement with their name on it and the number of goals they played for the club and the dates. Obviously, that includes Hugo Sanchez because he played more than 100 games for Atletico Madrid. But before he went to Real Madrid, having been top scorer at Atletico, and I think was top scorer at Real Madrid for four, maybe even five seasons in a row at Real Madrid, fans weren't very happy about this. Obviously, the criteria was very clear. You play 100 games, you're on here, no matter what. And so the fans decided to take matters into their own hands, or perhaps more to the point, into their own feet, and sort of scuff up the little plaque and put some stickers over it and basically try and make a mess of it.
Philippe has a question.
Hello, Sid.
Hello, Philippe.
It's about Loïc Rémy. What's happening? He's scoring.
People
had forgotten that he was still playing football, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, but I think doesn't this happen a lot, that you have players that because I think one of the things, maybe we're all guilty of this, that we sometimes perhaps shouldn't forget, is that no professional player is actually rubbish. No professional player is actually useless. There's all sorts of reasons why players fail. Some are not as good as maybe they should be. It's true. But there's all sorts of reasons why players don't work. And sometimes a change of environment, a change of team, a change of surroundings, of style of football can completely change a player's career. It can also, of course, be a one-off.
Or a two-off in this case. Two shots, two goals for young Loïc.
Devin White wasn't that great, I'll be honest, as a professional footballer. Barry, I'm sure you've got some Sunderland players who could fit into that category. Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Cheers. Sid Lowe out in Spain. Hey, Philippe, France.
Oui, oui.
What's the news?
No news. All quiet on the Western Front. Paris has won again. A very strange game in which they were not exactly convincing, to say the least. Two own goals by Lyon. It was very much a grudge game. Not really between the two teams, two sets of players, but between the two chairmen, Nasser Al-Khelaifi and Jean-Michel Aulas. Jean-Michel Aulas has probably been the only club chairman in France who's gone to war, basically, with PSG over the Qatari money and over the way they're spending it, which has created an awful lot of bad blood between the two clubs. And PSG were, I don't know, they look a little bit smug and complacent. Certainly they did on that particular occasion. Perhaps Genesio, the Lyon manager, had a decent game plan and so forth. It was nothing to shout about. And the problem is that we're looking at the table and we're wondering where they're going to lose points. And that's not healthy at all.
Jake asked on Twitter, what did you make of the Neymar-Cavani penalty argument? I didn't see this. God. Was it one of these, I want the ball, you want the ball?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, and Cavani missed it.
Brilliant. Wasn't good, though, was it? It really, really did not look good at all, the way that Neymar picked up the ball and then Dani Alves wrestled it and then Cavani ended up with it. It was.
If only there was a way of working out before the game who was going to take the penalties. I don't know.
Really didn't look good for them at all. I mean, imagine the egos in that dressing room.
Similar thing between Raheem Sterling and
Aguero.
Sergio Aguero. Yeah. But that passed off relatively peacefully.
So I'm a big fan of them. I mean, I like to see more of them, but they're not good for your
really
team.
It was not an argument. I mean, the Raheem Sterling, it was actually quite good natured. I didn't see that at an argument. This was different. This not pleasant at all.
Real animosity in it. And then for the bloke to go and... Well, actually, in fairness, it was a fabulous save, wasn't it, from Lopez? It was absolutely brilliant save. But it was amusing afterwards when Cavani was waving, gesticulating. It looked as though he was trying to claim that it had crossed the line and it was a yard away. Perhaps he was complaining that Lopez had come off his line. I don't know. But that one's going to be interesting to see how that transpires with those egos.
Hey, Barry, Italy...
Yes.
What's the news?
Napoli and Benevento played what I think was their first ever Serie A derby over the weekend. They last played.
It went well. It went well, didn't it?
They last played each other in a competitive match around 13 or 14 years ago in the third division after Napoli had been relegated for financial reasons. I think they've gone bankrupt or something. The Benevento coach, Marco Baroni, is a former Napoli player. He won the championship with them. But he was unable to do a number on his old club, who ran out 6-0 winners. Dries Mertens got a hat-trick. And it means Napoli are top of Serie A on goal difference ahead of Juve and Inter, who also have 100% records of 4 wins out of 4.
I'd like to know what Dries Mertens' numbers are over the calendar year or the last season and now a quarter. It's just insane, really.
Well, you're looking at the wrong person.
Okay, all right.
If you're hoping to get them here.
Did you mention Dybala's hat-trick?
I didn't, no.
Ah, well, if you want to see someone who's really good at football scoring a hat-trick, then find that on your social media.
Which is going
excellent.
To feed yet more of the debate in Italy. Is Juve too Dybala dependent when he's not firing on all cylinders? Q game against Barcelona. Or he's not around. Juve are not the team they used to be. Blah, 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 blah. But he's truly exceptional,
yeah.
Isn't he?
He's lovely.
There's also sort of a bit of a debate. I wouldn't say raging, but simmering. That there's just too many bad teams in Serie A.
Something which could be said of a number of leagues.
Well, yes.
I mean, difficult for them when you
look at... Like, say, the bottom four teams, I think, after four rounds of matches, have three points and 4 goals between them. And in her Football Italia column, Susie Campanale, who we've had on this show in the past, said that it's a genuine concern that there are too many bad teams and that having 3 teams with 100% records at top of the division is not a good thing.
Germany. Doing Germany? Are you doing Germany,
sorry,
Jackie?
Before we move on.
Oh, yeah. Crack
about
on.
The 16-year-old who came off the bench for Genoa and equalised twice for them. And they went on to lose 3-2 against Lazio. But 16 years of age, he was born in March 2001.
Oh,
and
no.
His hero is Zlatan Ibrahimovic, who had already won 2 senior caps for Sweden when he was born.
Oh,
how
it's
scary
just so depressing,
is
isn't
that?
It? I mean, what's the point? As we all just float on towards death.
And his dad was sitting on the bench because he's friends with the manager and he'd been brought in and his dad was crying on the bench. It was quite a moving thing.
Germany, 2 goals each for Maximilian Philipp and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang mean Dortmund are top of the table. They beat Cologne 5-0. Cologne have 0 points but have scored a goal, so they are better than Crystal Palace. Hanover won on Friday night, their second. Bayern a third, a 4-0 win over Mainz. Müller, Robin and a brace from Lewandowski. And Bayer Leverkusen picked up their first win of the season. Left Freiburg still looking for theirs with a 4-0 win. Colo Touré has retired from football and taking up a coaching role with
only
Celtic.
Man to have gone through a whole season and beaten in Scotland and England.
Yeah.
Amongst other things, absolutely.
So well done and good luck to Colo.
Everyone likes Colo Touré.
Yeah.
Yes, because he's a lovely man.
But there is a short list of people in football who everybody likes.
Juan Mata is definitely
that's
one
true.
Today.
And some American, some female American footballers have joined, soccer players have joined his 1%.
The Common Goal project,
yeah.
Yep.
There are 4.
He's picking up quite quickly, actually.
Yeah.
I think
there are
more announcements to come very, very soon.
It's a great scheme, isn't it? It's absolutely brilliant. But Juan Mata's got to be the one. But that's a good question, that. Which footballers are universally
Gianfranco
popular?
Zola was another one.
True.
Not with Birmingham fans.
Oh, like. As a person. Robbie Dennison.
That's a good question.
He's
completely liked and loved footballers go below the line. Put them in. Here are some questions. Lewis asks, in a Premier League clone 11, which player would be best suited to play in every position? I'm inferring this as you can have 11 of the same player, right? So you could have 11 Peter Crouches or 11 Lee Catamoles. Which one player are you picking to do well in the Premier League? I think you've got to take goalkeepers out of this, because otherwise it's ridiculous. Unless you get Niall Quinn was quite good in goal, but would struggle as
Robbie
a winger.
Robbie Savage was good in goal. Also have a blinder at Reading for Derby when he won in goal.
Actually, yeah. 11 Savages.
Oh, God.
The hair flying everywhere.
One is one too many. Don't talk to me about 11.
A team of Savages.
I'd say James Milner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You would expect in the men's game, and I'd say Kelly Smith in the women's game.
Okay. Ben asks, would you say Barry Glendening is totally dead inside, or now a robot simply acting out life, emotionless until the end of time?
It's not really for me to say.
I think Barry has more heart and soul than he lets on.
It's a little tear trickling down the side of his face.
It's kind of Wizard of Oz sort of machine.
Yeah, do you think so? Feedback corner, Matt Parkinson.
Oh, well, that isn't even feedback corner.
No, that's a question. That's not feedback corner. Feedback corner, Matt Parkinson, who is a coach at New England Revolution, says, thanks for mentioning New England Revolution's 9-man display, the club I coach getting worldwide press. They lost 6-0 to Atlanta, and their stats were, you know, no shots, no corners, no nothing. I ignored the fact because I didn't know that they'd had two men sent off. So, I would, you know, it's now qualified to those people who thought New England were rubbish. They're not as rubbish as I said they were. Well, it was 7-0. They just scored again, Atlanta, even a week later.
Depends on why those men were sent off.
That's a good point.
Don't get men sent off.
We were all surprised last week that Ryan Babel was at Beşiktaş and that he was only 30. Essies writes, he was also in the Holland side in the latest qualifiers. So, you know, Ryan Babel is doing.
I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, though. Yeah.
No, but it's the fact that he's still existing and it had passed us by.
You see players who you'd totally forgotten about just appear from nowhere, like Adel Tarabd at the weekend.
Oh, where's he?
He was appearing as a false nine.
He's been a false 8 and 10 and 11, hasn't
he? In Italy for Genoa, I think it was. And he's on loan there. And he hadn't scored a top-level goal for 3.5 years, and yet he's playing as a false nine. Well, fair play to him.
Well, I mean, he's
still going.
He is the only professional footballer to never have passed the ball, ever. So, you know, fair play, he's still getting picked.
I interviewed Neil Warnock once, and he could not speak highly enough of Adel Tarabd. And so he was one of the greatest players he'd ever seen. Huge future in the game.
Yeah. He's very talented.
Money or something.
On the subject of overrated goals, Tony says, most overrated goal, Carlos Alberto versus Italy, 1917. Look at exhausted Italians out on their feet days after the 4-3 match of the century, but also because conventional footage shows a narrow space that Pelé's blind pass found him in, but the reverse angle shows acres of space unpatrolled by a tired side. Anyone want to speak up for one of the greatest goals of all time?
You've just spoken nonsense, totally shot the credibility of the show by repeating this outrageous claim.
I'm just a conduit. Macca says, on the subject of overrated goals, it's always baffled me how efforts from the halfway line are deemed as great, e.g. Rooney versus West Ham, Beckham versus Wimbledon, Adam versus Chelsea. All they're doing is humping a ball forward. The goalkeeper's out of position. No real skill or technique required.
I
suspect he's never tried to kick a ball into a goal from a halfway line.
I would suggest that he has a look at the goal that Nabil Fekir scored from the halfway line in the French League this season, which is truly the goal of the season, because it was a shot, not a lob.
Mm. From 53
yards.
Preston as well in the week from the halfway line after clearance.
On the Barney Rone bandwagon of Paul Scholes wasn't actually that good. Ape says the worst tackler I've ever seen. Nick says I think Scholes was pretty good, but a lot of his reputation comes from the fact Zidane once commented that he was one of the best midfielders he played against. Still remember a dreadful defensive header to let Hasselbank in against Chelsea about 15 years ago. On the subject of shaving legs, which was it Marco Asensio, was it?
Mm.
He shaved his legs and got a spot with inflamed.
That's apparently untrue.
Oh, that's a shame.
Apparently he had an infected insect bite.
Oh.
Which can actually be pretty irksome.
So how did that come out, as he had an infected pimple from shaving his legs then?
No. I think that Zidane said he had an infected pimple, and people said, it's because he shaves his legs. No, you can have an infected pimple because you've been bitten by an insect.
So that was just assumed and then grew legs, so to speak.
We got onto the subject of cyclists shaving their legs, and MJB said it's not for speed purposes, but because it makes dealing with grazes from crashes easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then Slim Pickens wrote, you know, without the stories about meat, cycling, etc., we could get this over within half an hour. We'd get a pithy, informative podcast, and you'd get to go home early. And you might think you're appreciating male beauty. I have a man crush on Fernando Llorente. It says, I think you're just objectifying men in the same way your predecessors did with women. And Rizzle says, please, 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 can we have Barry's Irish Sports podcast?
Well, Mayo lost their ninth consecutive All-Ireland final since 1951 yesterday. They've now lost 4 in 6 years, and I think they should just take a couple of years out from playing because it's just tragic. Half beyond belief. The manner in which they keep finding new and interesting ways of shooting themselves in the foot. Yesterday, with half an hour to go, Dublin were about to have a man sent off. Mayo were only about a point behind. They would have won the game, and one of their fullbacks steamed in, windmilling, and got himself sent off as well in an act of retaliation, and that cost them this one. But yeah, it's just tragic. It's gone beyond Jimmy White levels of tragicness.
Is it up to Ivan Lendl Wimbledon levels?
Well, Ivan Lendl was winning other stuff. Oh, so was okay. Jimmy White.
It's Jimmy, yeah.
But
every year it felt like.
And also, just finally, we have a problem with some people downloading this podcast on iTunes. It's not all iTunes, it's some iTunes thing. I mean, clearly, if you're listening to this bit, you're not one of them. So, you know, I would say to you, you're the ones we really care about. But if you've had to find a new way to listen to this, apologies. And, you know, obviously this wouldn't have happened in the old times, would it? Barry, thanks for your time.
Cheers.
Jackie, thanks very much.
Thanks, man.
Philippe, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.